Shanti. So I hope everyone is back. And I hope you're enjoying this. We have one question. You have to speak really loudly because I've got the mic and you don't. Okay, that's an important question. I'll just take up this one because I didn't actually complete properly. Brother's question was, Brother's question was that if Srimat is what God tells us, if Paramat is conventional morality, what other people tell us, which are the external moral authorities, parents, teachers, a lot of the media, religious leaders, or there's the messages that you get from birth about who to be, how to be, what to be, and what not to be, and so on and so forth. Conventional morality. And then Manmat is actually, you internalize that as you grow up. Because as a child, you just lap it up. And then it becomes your ideas. But it came originally from the external moral authorities. And it's given a separate category as Manmat because you have no idea that they're not your own ideas. You think, yeah, this is my idea, but this was actually planted into you by somebody else. And now Shiv Baba is coming and planting something else. And you say, well, let me think about that. And many people, for many people, it's uncomfortable to have to decide for yourself what's right and what's wrong, and then go along with that, even if the rest of the world doesn't agree, because you have to take such a risk at every step. So that's why it's all very not so easy Raj Yoga. It's easy Raj Yoga, but not so easy. It's very true in the Brahmin family, because in the Brahmin family, generally speaking, people think that values and ethics and morality and virtues is all the same thing. It's not. Virtues come from the ocean of virtues, which is Shiv Baba, and morality, ethics, and values, they come from people who are the elite of any particular society. And so they vary from place to place, from culture to culture, from time to time. And you can have a clash of values. You very often get clashes of values. But I've never seen a clash of virtues. Have you? Have you seen kindness clash with sweetness? They go together, not a problem. Anyway, that comes later. In fact, if you go on to the Raj Yoga TV, you will see a series of 58 videos on that subject. All the different angles that you can have about virtues, values, ethics, and morality. And that's the name of the series. So that's there. Anyway, but now, back to the Gita. So, you have a question? Oh, the difference between the Mahabharat, the Vedas, and the Ramayana. In 2 minutes, right? Well, no, it's very relevant because in the Gita is set in the Mahabharat, but it's talking about the Ramayana. And interestingly, Arjuna's chariot has a flag 3 miles high, very inconvenient for going under bridges and trees, but the flag has got Hanuman on it, who is a character from the Ramayana, you see. And it's quite interesting that there are these references to the Mahabharata in the Ramayana and to the Ramayana in the Mahabharata and in the Gita. So India is very intricately woven tapestry that is indecipherable to anyone except Jeev Baba. Unfortunately, we have him as our teacher, and so he's helping us, he's giving us the keys, you see, so that we can unravel it and figure it out and operate, you know, these things all together. Now, the Vedas, these are created by people, scholars, and there are four Vedas, and they're referred to a lot in the Gita. And there is something called Vedanta, which is an angle of vision, a mat. We have Sri Mat, and Vedanta is another kind of mat. And basically, Vedanta is the explanation of omnipresence. And so they will cause you a lot of confusion if you are a person who says, I'm a soul, he's Jeev Baba, and all the rest is drama. Whereas Vedanta says, no, you know, you're all part of God, and the whole game is just a game, and nothing's really there. And so might as well go to Nirvana, where there's really nothing there. And that's the aim of Vedanta, is to go to Nirvana. And so for us, our aim is mukti, but not moksha. Moksha means you go to Nirvana, you don't come back. Mukti is you go to Nirvana, spend not more than 1 second there, because there's no time anyway, and then come back in Jivan Mukti, which is liberation in life, the golden age. You see, but we know this, but other people don't know this, or they look at it very differently. And so, you can imagine, you know, the world as it is presently constituted has got maybe 80% of the souls arrived after the Second World War. And they don't have any experience of life before that. So, as far as they're concerned, you know, it's all about destruction. And maybe they're causing destruction, I don't know. But they prefer moksha. Well, it's like we have Cinderella, and we have Sleeping Beauty, and we have Snow White, and they're all the same thing. Different story to tell the same thing. So the story is, you know, you can say, okay, one very interesting difference. In the Ramayana, Ram is following morality, which causes him to fail. And in the Mahabharata, Krishna, the hero of the Mahabharata, goes against morality and wins. So, you know, when a BK comes into BK, the first thing that you learn is you should be vegetarian, right? And then you say, yeah, that's good, I'll be vegetarian. No more meat, fish, eggs, or anything that has a mother. And then you encounter opposition from other people in your family or your social group who say that there's something wrong with that, you see. And there you get a big clash between morality. I think the Russian translation is not happening. Are you okay now? Okay. Anyway, so the you find yourself at odds, you know, and then you say, okay, I'm not smoking, drinking, or anything like that. And then they say, well, you know, you're such boring BKs, you know. And so you can see right there's a difference. And you're always having to deal with people who accuse you of some wrongdoing by being vegetarian, celibate, continent, pure, all those things. You know, they say that that's going to be a bad thing, or else it makes other people look bad, and that's not good. Brother, translation problem. The translation brother is coming. I will continue. Can we put the video on? Or you want me to wait? I think he came. So it's complicated, these stories, but what I did when I first came in Gyan, and you know, at that time there was nothing like the English Murli, didn't exist. It was Jen Tiben writing down in English what things Dadi Jenki was saying, and there was only about four of us in the class anyway. And so I would ask about every single thing, and then I decided I have to really know all these stories. I have to read as many versions as I can of these scriptures so that I can figure out what this all is, you see, because otherwise it's like a balloon in the air, you know, Gyan. And you have to bring it down to earth, and you have to, from my angle, it has to be in context, you see. Because if you cross from one way of thinking to another way of thinking, you have to have all the planks and bricks in place to actually make the crossing. Is the translation all right now? Yes? Okay, so I'm going to invite you to watch the second video, and we'll take out some of the white lights up here. Hello, a very warm welcome to the Gita Decoded. This is the introduction, part 2 of the series. Sister Denise is taking us through a synopsis of the entire Bhagavad Gita in these first 2 episodes, so that you, the reader of the Bhagavad Gita, and the audience can get a true picture of the message that is contained in this ancient Indian scripture. Sister Denise, a very warm welcome to episode 2.
Thank you.
Sister Denise, when we ended the last episode, you spoke about who the Yadavas were, who the Kauravas were, who the Pandavas were, the fact that the Bhagavad Gita is an allegory. The question that I have for you now is the war that is taking place. Is it an external war with bows and arrows as depicted in the Bhagavad Gita, or is there a deeper meaning behind it? So my question is this war internal or is it external?
I think, in fact, it's both.
Okay.
There is an internal war.
Okay, I'm slightly confused because I would have thought it would have been one or the other.
Well, no. It's the Gita, as you know, layers upon layers upon layers.
Mm.
There are many wars going on in the world as we know it. On the one hand, the Gita is about civil war, which is a very terrible kind of war. It's about war within families. And this is also something that we find in the world today. There is a lot of conflict within families. Domestic violence is an example of a very extreme form of conflict within families. So many people are having an inner war. How difficult is it to follow the voice of conscience? There's such a war going on inside. It's very difficult for a person to know what's right. You know, people who are interested in matters of spirituality are moral. They are concerned to live a righteous life. But they have to battle with different aspects of their personalities. Everybody has their shadow. There's a lot of wars going on. It is said famously that war begins in the minds of men. And so, okay, you think about you want to take over somebody else's land or you want to expand your territory and so on. So history is all about the rise of civilizations, the rise of different clans, and so the historical record is full of blood and battlefields and feuds, family feuds and so on. And I think that the Gita is really describing all of these different layers that are happening. And the Gita is in the context of the Mahabharata, which literally means the Great World War, the Last World War. And interestingly, in the Mahabharata, there are sacred weapons, you see. And sacred weapons, in a way, correspond in terms of how they're described to the kinds of military equipment that is available today, which never was before. So in earlier times, people thought that the writers of the Gita had a very vivid imagination, and now we see that we have it. We can do this. And where a sacred weapon is set off by a mantra, our weapons are set off by formulae that you just type into a computer and off it goes. You can't call it back.
So Denise, we see Arjuna at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita as a man who is extremely tormented, torn apart, at a loss at what to do, and at odds with himself and in great pain. Then we see Arjuna throughout the book changing. His feelings change, his attitude change as the conversation between him and God unfolds. So my question to you is, what is Arjuna's journey?
I think Arjuna's journey is our journey, because there are people in this world, quite a lot of people in this world, whose life is motivated by a quest. And you can say it's a quest for truth. It could be a quest to understand the world, life and everything. For some people, it's literally a quest to find God. For some people, it's a quest to find yourself. And the Gita is really the story of all of these quests. And Arjuna, I think, is really the person, the character, who represents this difficult situation between, or the relationship between a person and God, a person and truth, a person and their destiny. See, because the question of destiny comes in there too. Arjuna is caught by his destiny. He can't avoid the war. He does everything possible to avoid the war. And Krishna, God, says, no, you have to fight. And anyway, everybody's already dead, so all you have to do is just kill them. And it's such a difficult set of ideas to get your mind around, because you find yourself identifying with Arjuna, and you want to be right, you want to be moral, you want to listen to God. A lot of the time it's really a conflict between the voice of conventional morality and the instructions of God, which go totally against it. And so you're really caught between what the world considers to be right and then these directions coming from Krishna, which are very different. And so the conversation between Arjuna and Krishna is where Arjuna is gradually getting clarity and moving away from coming under the influence of the traditions, which is what we are all under, the influence of traditions. And then there's the influence of God, which is coming out of nowhere, a different influence, you see. And the traditions are sending everybody in a direction which is what you don't want, which is what everything collapses. Yeah, the downfall of civilization. The key point in the Gita is that Dharma is getting destroyed because of human weakness.
I'm going to interject there. Denise, define Dharma for the viewer.
Dharma, you see, Dharma is one of the gods. So, for example, in terms of the Pandavas' parentage, Dharma is the father of Yudhisthira, who is the eldest Pandav. And Dharma means the rule of righteousness.
The rule of law.
The rule of law, but not man-made law. The rule of righteousness is, in a way, a better word, because law, as created by lawyers and legislators and all of this, is in a way a response to circumstances which require the governing bodies to make new laws, whereas Dharma precedes things that happen. So Dharma exists independently of human crime, for example. Dharma means the right way to be. And of course in India there's the whole question of the castes, and so you have to follow the dharma of your caste, and then you have to know, well, what caste are you? So there's caste born people according to the system of caste, but there's another angle on caste even. Now, what kind of a person are you? So in the Western world, in the world of psychology, there are a lot of people who draw up different personality types, which in some ways correspond to caste system, you see. And then in Brahma Kumaris, we are taught that, you know, your caste is very much determined by what your motivations are, what kind of a person you are, what quality, what standards you maintain as a human being. This will, you know, denote your caste. You can look at it that way too. So all of this is very complicated, and so we have to take time to unravel everything.
Okay, it's a good thing we have an entire series there.
Yes.
So Denise, we meet God, who speaks to Arjuna, and the Gita is the result of that conversation, depicts that conversation. So we meet God in his capacity as the teacher and the sermonizer of the Gita. Could you explain God's title in this respect? Is this God's primary role in humanity, to impart knowledge of how to be?
I'm reminded when you say this of the biblical expression that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, you know, and this is a phrase that the Christian scholars think over a great deal and try to interpret. It's very difficult to interpret, but what you can get from that is that God, who's also described in other religions as the Supreme Intelligence, you see. And even we have this simple expression when we speak to each other, you know, God knows. If you don't know something, God knows. So there is an assumption, there's a some sort of an awareness generally that God is the one who knows what people don't know. We also have this idea of the third eye which comes in. And the third eye is very much the idea of an ability to see, to comprehend, to understand things that are not comprehensible to those who just have two eyes. And then there's another thing which is very difficult for people to work with. That's the idea of, you know, the hierarchy. There's man is on the top, mammals and, you know, reptiles, amphibians, and all the hierarchy all the way down to stones. But above man is God. And God is not comprehensible by definition to man. But man is interested very much in being able to understand God. When I say man, I mean humanity. And so women, men, Purush. This word Purush, which means man, means human, is also applied to Purush, God. When you make God as a human-like person, you bring God down. If you say God is not an individual, you lose contact with the possibility of accessing the intelligence of God. So this becomes a problematical situation for scholars and philosophers to try to figure out what is this thing which is above humanity. And so it's only possible, I think Teilhard de Chardin, the theological philosopher, had said only God can describe himself. And I like that expression very much because it opens up the possibility that God can say to us, you know, this is who I am, this is what I am, I will help you to understand me. And I think this is also very much what the Gita is about, totally.
Sister Denise, when does the Bhagavad Gita play out? And the reason I'm asking this is it is not in dispute that it's a scripture that was written thousands of years ago, and there's some controversy as to when it was written. However, if you read the Bhagavad Gita in today, the 21st century, it's like you're reading a scripture that was meant to be read today.
Yes.
Okay? So this war, which you say, which is both internal and external, at what point in humanity does it play out? Is it a scripture of the past for the present? Is it a scripture for the future? It's
the conventional interpretation is that it is written in the, or it is taking place in what we call the Copper Age. So the Copper Age is, say, you know, the time when most of the religions were set up, the major faith traditions, 2 to 2,500 years ago from now. At that time, as you can see from lots of various different scriptures and traditions, there was a lot of war going on, where the similar weapons, other than the sacred weapons, were being used, you know, spears and tridents and swords and all of this, which is how we usually see the Gita, the Mahabharata, depicted, with a lot of horses and chariots and elephants and everything. But as you say, reading it now, we would say this is absolutely current. And I believe that it is referring to the present time. With the studies that we do in the Brahma Kumaris, we also look at it as something that refers to the present time. And we also look at the idea of time going in cycles, where the circumstances, which you can also see in the stars, you know, the the position of the stars will replicate itself after cycles. So we look at it like that. That this is the time when Dharma is at its lowest ebb, where there is extreme of conflict, where there is extreme of, there's one very famous phrase in the Gita that's very often quoted. I will not quote the Sanskrit because I can't do it so well. But the translation is something to the effect that at the time when there is the extreme of irreligion and unrighteousness in Bharat. So Bharat means India, it means the land of plenty, it can also mean the whole world. So when things reach their extreme, it is the promise of God, at that time I will come and I will destroy all forms of irreligion, adharma, this and antithesis of right way of being, and I will establish true dharma. So very often the word dharma is translated as religion. And so you have Hindu dharma, Buddhist dharma, Christian dharma, Islamic dharma, etc. These are the different religions. But the word dharma also means religion in a general sense, where religion means that people are in line with what God represents. They're in line with truth. They are acting in a God-like way. And it doesn't really matter what faith tradition you are in. And when God appears to humanity, it is a time of great darkness. So in terms of the yugas, the time periods that we talk about in terms of the Hindu time cycle, you have Satyuga, the age of truth, or the golden age. Then you have Treta Yuga, which means the three quarters, and we call the silver age. Then you move into the second half of the cycle, Dwapara Yuga, where everything is split into two. And there is a bifurcation of the religious and political powers. They separate. So the religious powers go to the religious leaders, and the political powers go to the political leaders, and they are then two big powers who have to work together or in antagonism or however. And then the last age is the Kali Yuga, which is the dark age, the age of negativity. And it is really actually we feel in the Kali Yuga that the great world war would take place, which destroys civilization as we know it. And then you see the message of the Gita is, if you can make yourself so lined with God that you are untouched by the forces of negativity, then you can become the new bud of a new civilization, you see. And so in terms of the cycling of time, is a better time to have the Gita take place in between the Kali Yuga, the age of darkness, and then the Satyuga, the age of truth, because it would follow in a very good way. You know, if you have the Gita in the Copper Age, in the Dwapara Yuga, and Dwapara Yuga is succeeded by Kali Yuga, and so the knowledge of the Gita should not really lead to Kali Yuga, but it seems better if from Kali Yuga it leads to the age of truth, because it's set up by God, who is truth.
Sister Denise, when two parties engage in a war, they're fighting over something, or sometimes someone. What is the prize when the Kauravas and Pandavas engage in war? The aim is to annihilate each other to gain something. What is to be gained?
The prize is the kingdom of the world. And the reason why they're fighting is because, going back to the background history of the Mahabharata, the father of the Kauravs and the Pandavs is the same one, but the mother is different. And the second wife wanted her children to be the heirs to the kingdom. And he agreed to that through trickery. And then he said, well, we have to at least give something to the Pandavs. But the Kaurav sons, Duryodhana and all, they wanted, and Dhritarashtra, they wanted everything because they were afraid of the Pandavs. And they felt that if the Pandavs had anything, they would get everything, because whenever the Pandavs had anything, which in the story they sometimes got, they would be given very wretched places of territory, and out of that they would make something extraordinary, and everybody would love the Pandavs and not the Kauravs. And so the Kauravs didn't like that. So there's jealousy, there's fear, there's all of these negative emotions motivating the Kauravs to demand everything. And then, you know, they had this game of dice and they lost, and then they went again and again, and they did their years in exile and so on. And the agreement was broken by the Kauravs in the end, which forced the Pandavs into a position where they had to fight for their rights. And that is the situation of the Mahabharata.
So Denise, if we look at the world and its history, mankind has been presented with exceptionally bright philosophers, metaphysicians, etc. And when one reads the Bhagavad Gita, it's the word of God that is presented to Arjuna, and therefore to humanity, to on, I think, how to be and what to do. Now, because it's a book, it's theory. Mm-hmm. Part of it is theory. But my question to you is the Bhagavad Gita meant to be just theory, or is the intention of God in imparting this wisdom to humanity, is the intention of that to say, this is how you should be? And in that sense, I think this is where the dichotomy comes in, because we all believe we should be like this, but yet we don't live up to our own expectations, let alone the standards of others. So my convoluted question is the Bhagavad Gita theory?
Any human being wanting to live a righteous life finds that he or she is unable to live up to their own standards, let alone any other standards. So God is giving very, very high standards. And if you are not able to take power from God directly, you're not able to live up to those standards. And so until God is practically, literally accessible and available, it's not possible to do that. So as long as God is inaccessible, the teachings of God are impractical. And so it remains a nice idea, it remains theory, and people aspire to live like that, but they know, you know, the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak, this kind of expressions we use, you know. And the thing that I think is perhaps new and different is that if we are indeed at that time when we've reached the limits, when we are on the threshold of a great huge war, a war to end all wars, is sometimes said. If we are at a time when God is actually here and actually giving us the knowledge of the Gita all over again, then maybe it can be a practical reality. But this is really the question that's at issue here, is it possible for me as a basic, normal, ordinary human being to have access to God, to listen to the instructions, which is part of the title, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, literally means the supreme directions of God, and Gita is the song, which means also the statements. So can I actually live according to these statements? So I need how to interpret it, have to interpret it right, and I also have to have the power to do it, because the thing is, people do not have the power to even follow their own standards. So this is a big thing, and this is really what yoga is about. Yoga means to stabilize the mind on the being of God directly, in order to be able to take the power so that you can actually do what is being asked of you. That's the big question.
Okay, we will come to that in future episodes, okay? Because I'd like to ask you more on that. Sister Denise, given the fact that we're living in the 20th century and the world has become what is now commonly called a global village, mm-hmm. what I find curious is there are a number of people who are not Hindus who have taken up the Bhagavad Gita in order to read and practice it. Why has the scripture become of late, and of late could mean 20, 30, 40, 50 years, of interest to people who are not Hindus, who are not born into a Hindu family, or mm-hmm. somebody like you, for example?
Mm. You know, when India was colonized by the European countries in the 18th, 19th centuries, the scholars and intellectuals from the Western countries started to translate this, and it opened up a huge area that people were absolutely astounded by, because in the scriptures that were normally made accessible to the Europeans, there was nothing like the detail about the soul, about consciousness, about karma, about God. Nothing like that, you see. And so people were absolutely fascinated. And it started to enter into academic studies, literature. Writers would include a lot of the stories. The great composers would take melodies from India and work that into their operas and symphonies and so on. So the Europeans really gravitated towards this and wanted to include it in the culture. And the Gita really was felt to belong to everyone. And I think that, you know, just for my own self, I find it so personally relevant to my thinking, to my life, and so on. And I don't think you have to become a Hindu to appreciate the Gita. I think it really makes you into a human being with fullest potential. So it's very, very attractive. And it's so deep that you can take lifetimes to, you know, dig deeper and deeper into it. And you will interpret it different ways at different times in your life according to your life experience.
Mm. So, Sister Denise, thank you so much for joining us today, and we've come to the end of the introductory chapters to the Bhagavad Gita. I hope you have taken as much as I have. Sister Denise has a very fresh and unusual approach to reading this ancient scripture. and she shares her knowledge and experience of it, and she leaves us with the question as to what the Bhagavad Gita means to you personally, and also not just to read it but to apply it in your daily life. So if you have enjoyed the introductory chapters, the introductory episodes of the Bhagavad Gita, I invite you to join us for the next episode, which goes into the actual chapters and the stanzas of this scripture, to see what it means and how it's relevant to your life in the 21st century. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to see you soon. Thank you and goodbye.
Om Shanti. So that was the, both together, that was the full introduction, and then the other episodes just go idea by idea, concept by concept, stanza by stanza, symbol by symbol, character by character, so that you can really follow the Gita as it unfolds. Excuse me. One of the things you see when you study the Gita is that very clearly there are very different voices as you go chapter by chapter. So some of the chapters are very clearly Vedantic in angle and style, and others are really not. And so you know, for most people it's very confusing, because the assumption is, because it says it's written by Vyas, that that's one person. But one of the things you have in India is a tradition of eponymous bodies of literature. And eponymous is a word that means that one name is given, but it's actually lots of people, all different, very different, but all under the name of one person. So it's eponymous. And another place in the Indian ancient literature where you find this eponymous voice is the Manusmriti. Have you heard of the Manusmriti? So the Manusmriti usually is called the Laws of Manu. And the Laws of Manu is very similar to the Islamic Hadith. Have you heard about that? These are the sort of peripheral scriptures to the main scripture, to the Quran. You have the Hadith, and so these are like interpretations, and this is where you get the origins of the patriarchal angle on how life should be lived, and the big difference between, you know, the males and females. And this is one of the things that's a real issue at the moment, that why is it that women are badly treated in traditional society? It all comes from there, where it was felt that the easiest way to handle conflict is to say, you know, the male is always right, and the female is always wrong, and then you don't have any conflict. And that was okay for a little while, but it's not okay anymore. And so what's happening at this time is all of these human ways of dealing with the human problems that emerged in the Copper Age, which includes the main religions, the scriptures, the traditions, all of this was created by the rulers and the scholars of that period of time as their way to handle the situation. And the situation, you remember that the Copper Age is called the Age of Division into Two. Dwapur means you split into two. So everything that was integrated, harmonized, and united became split. And so the way the scriptural writers dealt with it was to give predominance to one side and second position to the other side, and that was their way of resolving it. And it worked for a while. But as time went by, and we get into the Kali Yuga, where the split is so huge and so irreconcilable and mixed up with all of these karmic accounts that were created along the way. And you see, I'll give you a very interesting, very graphic difference between a conventional morality and Srimat in regard to what's right and what's wrong. You know, Sri Baba says to us, do not give sorrow, do not take sorrow. Conventional morality says, do not give sorrow, but you can take as much as you want. And there's a huge difference. And the reason it's such a huge difference is because what we begin to realize when we study Gyan is that every time we're taking sorrow, we're performing a sin for which we have to pay by getting a bit more sorrow, which we also don't have to take, but which we do take, you see. And so it becomes a huge issue for a BK. How do I not take sorrow from these people who are giving me sorrow? Right? You see? So in conventional morality, you have two kinds of sins. In BK, you have three kinds of sins. And the two kinds of sin, one kind is don't give sorrow, don't do wrong things. And the other kind is do not fail to do what you have to do, because if you do not do what you're supposed to do, that's also a sin. If you do what you're not supposed to do, that's a sin. So there are two kinds. And then the added kind in BK is, if you take sorrow, that's another sin. You see, so you just try and count up all the times you took sorrow. You know, it's a lot, you see. And then once you realize this and you say, oh my goodness, what I really need to do is not take sorrow, because I'm quite reasonable at not giving sorrow. At least that's my good intention, right? And I try my very best to do what I'm supposed to do, but I never made the effort not to take sorrow. So it means we're really weak in that. And so you have to settle all of those additional sins. And so once you start to say, okay, well, how do I not take sorrow? And of course in the Gita, it says, well, you have to be dispassionate. You see? And someone comes along and gives you sorrow, you say, oh, that was interesting. It's a nice idea. If you really want to be doing negative karma, that's okay, you know, because you can be my servant in the golden age if you really want to. You know? You know, other people don't think like that, you know. And so it's just another angle that you start to get in the Gita when you see it through the light of Gyan, that it's all there. But people weren't able to interpret it in this way because of the dominance of the angles of the Manusmriti and some of the other orientations that were given in moral philosophy and there in the scriptures. And you see, what happens is we can very easily import those attitudes into our Brahman life, in the thought that this is all part of doing correct action, being moral people, right? You must be doing that, yeah? Is that right? Now if I tell you, don't do that anymore, you say, oh, I don't know if I can do that. You'll see in this part that the concept of destiny begins to appear. And in Gyan, Baba gives us the knowledge of drama. And it corresponds to when the idea of destiny is mentioned in the Gita. And it's a very deep subject, destiny. And that your relationship with your destiny is, again, a tricky thing, because you don't know what your destiny is, except that in the Gita, Krishna is saying to Arjuna, I know what your destiny is, and by the way, I'm going to tell you what your destiny is, and once you know it, you know, you can't get away from it, and so you have to fulfill it. And so his destiny was that he had to fight, he had to kill his relatives, and he had to win. And he didn't want to, because you can't enjoy winning against your relatives, who are subsequently just blood in the earth, which is going to create nice grass for your cows to eat. But, you know, you can't enjoy that milk because it's your relative's blood, you see. So sometimes we in Gyan also have to really deal with the realities of drama, and it's quite difficult for people to arrive at an angle on drama where you're okay with it. You know, I mean, many people, they say, okay, as a fact, every scene of drama is good, you see, but it doesn't seem good, you see. So then what do? You suppress your perception of how bad this scene is, so that you can pretend to yourself that it's good? That's pretense, you know. Then you have to figure it out from many amounts of journeying and thinking, so that you can get an angle on it, so that you can actually see the benefit of drama and that it is good. But this is a very big area that we have to work with. And so as the Gita progresses, the concept of destiny, or for us, the concept of drama, the knowledge of drama comes up time to time. And it is one of the most difficult things that people have to deal with, you know, because whoever you are, you can't suddenly be somebody else. You are you. So if you don't like who you are, that's great misfortune, because that's it forever. So when Baba says to us, you know, you are the most fortunate ones, you are the ones who know God, you are the ones who see God, and really gives you the inspiration to really see how your part overall is really good, and any little bits and pieces that emerge in day-to-day living, they are to be seen as very trivial. You have to have an angle on it that looks at it as trivial, whereas conventional morality would say it's a huge deal. So the difference of the angle of Srimat and the angle of conventional morality on your attitude to your circumstance, your personality, your history, your destiny, really can save you from getting quite depressed. So that's a very good thing. And the way that Baba was talking to us on day before yesterday, on the 3rd, you know, that Baba loves you. And then you ask yourself, well, do you love yourself as much as Baba loves you? Probably not. And why would that be? Is because you judge yourself against moral standards, and not against the angle by which God sees you. Because if you'd look at yourself as the way God sees you, you don't find any problem at all. He says, yeah, I like this one. I chose this one. This I like. This my child. That's it. And then you see from moral standards, who invented moral standards? People. You know, copper-aged people. With Rajasic mentality, which has now become Tamasic, you know. So are you going to go along with that? Why would you? doesn't make any sense when you analyze it in comparison with the angle that Shiv Baba has, which is sattvic. And one of the things you see a great deal in the Gita is an analysis of sato, rajo, and tamo. And this comes up in the Murali from time to time, but I think if you look at it in the light of how it comes up in the Gita, it'll give you a lot more angles, you see. Because you have a sato pradhan effort, rajo effort, tamo effort. Baba speaks about this. It also comes up in the Gita, you see. And when you make the comparison, I think it gives you an angle or some light to see it, you see, because everything that we hear in the Murali, Shiv Baba is speaking to us, and Brahma Baba is also speaking to us, you see. We have both voices. We have the voice of Bap and Dada. And then we have our own interpretation and the way we listen to it, you know. Every time you read a Murali, the same Murali, you experience it differently. I mean, I read the Murali every day 3 times or so. And one time in English, one time in Hindi, and I listen to it in Hindi usually. And each time is different, you see. Then if you read it again, it's again different. Because of our angle on ourselves at that moment, because of, I don't know, so many factors are involved. And how many Muralis can you read in a day, you know, with difficulty? You can give yourself the early morning time from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. to just do that. And this is what Dadi has recommended to us. And in the path of bhakti, they also say, you know, early morning time is good for your spiritual input because the rest of the day is a different mentality, is a different atmosphere, other things are going on. Your mind is worldly at that time. You know, and then we have our regular evening meditation that we do 7 to 7.30 or 7 to 8 or 6 to 8, whatever it is. That's also this way of handling the day. This is an ancient way of doing things. And so in many ways, what we're doing in the Brahma Kumari's practice of Raj Yoga corresponds to a very pure kind of bhakti. And yet, the interpretation, the explanation, the subtlety of how we do it determines how successful we are as BKs. And then the other message that comes continuously through the Gita is, you must be dispassionate. Whatever is happening, be detached. Be the detached observer. Because whatever it is okay. And the way that it affects you is the important thing. And how you use your 8 powers to mitigate the impact of circumstances on your soul determines your success or failure. But whether the thing itself is right or wrong is neither here nor there. It doesn't matter, you know. So from the angle of conventional morality, it matters. This is right, this is wrong. But from God's angle, it doesn't matter. What matters is how do you handle it? That's all that matters, you see. Because the things that are happening in the world, it's a machine. It's a game. It's a very, very complex game. Now, I don't know if any of you are gamers on the internet. Gamers? Any gamers here? No. No. There are some BK gamers. Quite some master gamers hidden away in corners. But you know, the interesting thing about that phenomenon of gaming is that you really see that what we think of as reality is hardly different from the game, which is absolutely virtual. It's all made up. But you get caught up in it, you get engaged in the same way as you get engaged in this, what we call the real world, you know? And then people say, well, the BK world is not the real world. They're out there, that's the real world. And gradually you start seeing, you know what? This is the real world. That's not the real world. Your angle becomes different. Okay, I'm going to stop there. We just have a little while if anybody has any questions or comments. And then just to remind you that we will come together at 2 o'clock this afternoon for the second part of this seminar. Does anybody have something? Yes, please. He's asking about Sato Rajo Tamo. There are several chapters in the Gita dedicated to explaining Sato Rajo and Tamo from many, many different angles. And so in the later episodes on the Gita, when we come to those chapters, we look at it in detail. So I think because what we did when we were recording is we had the Gita stanzas open in front of us, and we would read them out so people could hear them in the translation. Sometimes I would make a slightly different translation from the official one that we were working with, and then we would discuss it, you see. So there you've got, you know, the question of effort, satopradhan effort, or rajo tamo, or the intellect. You have a sato intellect, a rajo intellect, a tamo intellect, you know. And when we did that, it was done to enable you to decide for yourself, what are you, you know, because this is really a very important question. Even the question of caste, that also came up, you know. When in BK, when Baba said, okay, everybody give away their last name, you're just BK, whatever your first name is. You remember that? Maybe you don't remember that. But it was, all the last names were eliminated. And the reason is because in India, your last name denotes your caste. In every case. And so people, when they ask somebody what your name is, you're also getting the information of what your caste is, what part of India you come from, everything is contained in your name. And so Baba considered this very body conscious. And so he said, okay, your caste, as sometimes you hear in Murli, your caste is Brahmin. And you are Brahmins who are born through the mouth of Brahma. You are not caste born, womb born Brahmins. You are mouth-born Brahmins. That means that your Brahmanness has to do with your conduct, your attitudes, your standards, your sensibilities and sensitivities, and your how you conduct yourself and what you feel about different things, you know. And if you see, in the Gita, it describes exactly that, the kind of personality traits of a Brahman, of a Kshatriya, of a Vaishya, of a Shudra. And sometimes in our classes, I don't know nowadays not so much, but in earlier days, Dadi Jenki used to help us to understand this by describing that, okay, if you're a BK, but you are operating in a certain way, then you're actually a Shudra. So, you know, do you really want to do that? You know, or if somebody is always doing a lot of bargaining and I'll do this if you do that and wanting payment and gratitude and honoring and validation and whatnot, well, then you're a Vaishya, you're a businessman, you know. And a Brahman is all about not getting or not looking for the fruits of action. Yeah, that, so a lot of importance is given to that, that you do pure action without looking for the fruits. And if you are looking for the fruits, if you expect to be recognized, honored, appreciated and whatnot, then that's not a Brahman, that's a Vaish, that's a businessman. That puts you in the copper age. If that's where you want to go, be my guest. We don't need overcrowding in the golden age. You know? But it really helps a person to see, you know, am I really functioning as a Brahman, or am I still under the influence of conventional morality that says, well, I did this and nobody appreciated me and therefore that's wrong, you see. But from Baba's angle, that makes you a copper age person. Please. Do I think there is conventional morality in the yajna? I think all of us have a greater or lesser amount of conventional morality. And I think that there's bound to be a great deal of conventional morality in the yajna. This is normal, you know. But I think that by taking up the concept of comparing or naming Paramat as conventional morality, and then naming Srimat as, maybe you want to call it, non-conventional morality, it causes us to have to look at ourselves to see, you know, to what extent is my sense of morality imported from my non-gyan life and mixed into it. And to what extent am I getting past it? Because in my own spiritual journey, I observed that every so often I would stop and calculate the whole thing all over again and evaluate everything, and my standards would change. So that things that I thought, you know, this is good, this is right, this is proper, after some time I would drop it and say, you know, that stuff, it's all conventional morality now. We're creating something different. And I think that we, you know, we have this expression, Brahmin culture, which Baba introduced a few years ago, but nobody really knows what that is. Which means that we all have to think about, what do I think Brahmin culture is? And to me, Brahmin culture is a morality and an ethical system based on Srimat, based on soul consciousness, rather than the conventional morality, which is based on body consciousness. And in conventional morality, your identity is either you're a male or a female, or any alternative in between. But in spirituality, you're a soul, and souls are genderless, colorless, classless, casteless, you know. So if you have a morality based on Srimat, it's very different from what I call conventional morality, which means each and every one of us has to decide for ourselves, what are my standards? And one of the things that's very important is we must never allow somebody else's conventional morality to interfere with my non-conventional morality, or to cause a block to my spiritual progress, because that's me taking sorrow, nothing else, you see. Because what is the yajna? The yajna is us. We are the yajna. The yajna is not buildings, it's people. And it's also, the yajna is an instrument designed by God to enable us BKs to create our fortune. As far as I can tell, that's what the yajna is. And it's a fire into which we surrender our body consciousness. You remember I told at the very beginning of this session, Rajasvaha, Ashwamegh, Rudra, Gita, Gyan, Yagya, Avinashi is in there somewhere as well. There's a long, long, long expression, you know, that this is the sacrificial fire in which the horse is sacrificed through the knowledge of the Gita, which is given by Rudra. Rudra means Shiva, you see. And this is what it is. It's all about giving up our body consciousness. And body consciousness is so subtle that it's quite hard to put a finger on it. And so this is why it goes on for years and years and years. And gradually, slowly, we shift and we start to understand it a little bit better than before. Please. Dispassionate? Dispassionate and indifferent. Very good question, yeah. You know, dispassionate, it's got the word passion in it. So, passion is you get angry. So, if something offends your sense of right and wrong, you will get distressed, disturbed, angry, upset, or something. So there'll be some passion in there. And sometimes Baba says that this is a sign of ego. We have an ego reaction when we think something is not right. And then if you look at indifferent, the word indifferent is... when you say the word different, to me it corresponds to the word discrimination. So if you are unable to discriminate between one thing and another thing, you just avoid the whole thing and just throw out the baby with the bathwater. Indifferent. To me it's a bit like that. So what I feel we can acquire is an inner position towards whatever is happening or however anybody is behaving. It doesn't really matter who or what. But I need to be cool so that I can see something which I know by my power of discrimination, this is a wrong action, and be detached. Yes, I think so. It's like being neutral. Because you see, there's this machine going on. And the machine is rather like a school for actors, okay? In the school for actors, there's one particular kind of acting school called the method acting, which is invented by someone called Stanislavski, he's a Russian acting teacher. Very, very famous. And he would teach the actors by putting them in a situation, saying, okay, you're the mother, you're the husband, you're the child, you're the lover, whatever. Here's the situation, now play it out, you know. And they had to play it out and find the emotions and the words and the angles and whatever. And this is very much what we do on a daily basis. We say, I am the whatever role we decide we are, and then this is a situation, and it's a bad thing, or whatever. And then we play our role like that. And it involves a lot of passion, and we may create some karmic accounts, and we may come out with feeling righteous indignation, or things like this. And then... ultimately, we find ourselves in loss. And then we have to sort of go back to the drawing board, back to square one, and say, oh, by the way, self, you know, what is this all about? What is Gyan anyway, you know? And so if you see that any situation, which Daddy very often says to us, you know, a situation will arise, it will persist for a while, and then it will subside. And all situations are like that. And we find ourselves as actors in these situations, And we have to figure out how to play the situation. And we will play it good, bad, or indifferent, whatever it is. But Baba is watching, and he's giving us a grade. And he's got this extremely complicated grading system for all of us, which at the end he will say, okay, you get, you know, X percent for this number. And it's so complicated that it's a bit difficult for us to figure out, but he seems not to have any problem with it, being a big mathematician of some sort. But we observe the situations repeat themselves, similar situations, because, as I mentioned earlier, the purpose of the other actors in the situations is to show us some aspect of ourselves which is in the way of our freedom. And that basically the whole machine is about that. And what we're learning is how to be free. And it's very practical, day-by-day thing, where we need the powers of yoga, and we need the knowledge of karma philosophy and all the rest of the knowledge at our disposal so that we can use our discrimination to decide how will I play this scene in such a way that I will come out free. Because victory is when you're free. And the situation is provoked by karmic accounts or by our, you know, insufficiencies, deficiencies, weaknesses, whatever. And Baba is not at all concerned whether something's right or wrong. He's concerned, can my child understand the nature of the exam and pass the exam by handling the situation in a certain way that the child becomes free? This is how I look at it. And then, you know, you're completely free from saying these people are good or bad or what or not. It's nothing to do with that. It's to do with me, you see. What is this situation telling me about me so that I can become truly me? You know? What do you think? I don't know. I think? And I think that this study of the Gita reinforces that idea. Because in the end, at the end of the Mahabharata war, all the bad people go to heaven, all the good people go to hell. And then they say, what is this? And then it's like, oh, well, that was only a game. Let's all go to heaven. Let's forget about good people and bad people. It's just roles, you know. And then Baba says, you know, make your fortune, create your status, but do not compare yourself with other BKs because it's misleading. And we generally do compare ourselves with other BKs, even though we know it's misleading. It means we haven't absorbed this point. So we have to find a way to get it so that we get it. But it's so subtle, so difficult that we don't get it. But we carry on studying until we do get it. And hopefully that will happen before the great destruction, which is being postponed pretty much indefinitely, while we get ourselves sorted out. Anyway, it's a little bit past 12:30, so let's have a minute of silence, and then please come at 2, and we'll go further till about 3:30, so that you can be to the next program by 3:45. Om Shanti.